That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Highwayman Dick Turpin is the quintessential English antihero. Appearing from the shadows, a handkerchief drawn across his face, before a whimpering nobleman hears the fateful words, "Stand and deliver, your money or your life." Roving the roads of Georgian England, robbing the rich, jumping fences on his faithful steed with two loaded pistols and the reins clamped between his teeth. Are the legends true? Was there really such a man? Or is the truth a much darker story? Join us for a bloodthirsty tale of murder and mayhem in the English countryside. This is Dick Turpin, Part 3. To Die Game. It's the 2nd of October, 1738. Brough, Yorkshire. 26 miles southeast of York. The cool October sun sets behind the Ferry Inn, casting a long shadow onto the cottages on the opposite side of the street. A group of men sit on horseback near the inn's stable yard, deep in conversation. From their good quality riding clothes, fine silk breeches, and colorful frock coats, it's clear these are upper-class gentlemen, or perhaps wealthier middle-class men, merchants, lawyers, or well-to-do yeoman farmers. The muskets and powder horns attached to their belts and the servant behind them carrying a sack full of birds tell a story of a good day's shooting. But the hunt hasn't been good for all of them. A Lincolnshire man named John Palmer dismounts his horse, handing the reins to a stable boy. Palmer's thunderous look betrays the fact that fortune hasn't been with him today, and anyone within earshot can hear the ribbing he's getting from the other men. Palmer's pockmarked face grows darker and redder by the second. The men say their goodbyes and ride away, leaving Palmer standing in the road, clenching his fists. There's a scratching in the dirt behind. Palmer turns to see a cockerel strutting out from one of the yards behind the cottages. Palmer glares at the animal, then pulls a loaded pistol from his pocket. He cocks it and pulls the trigger. There's a flash, an explosion of feathers, and the cockerel is obliterated. The bird's owner stops dead outside his cottage, aghast at such a cruel, senseless act. Palmer scowls at the local, still fuming at his disastrous afternoon. He picks up the dead bird and flings it over a fence into the field beyond. From the inn behind Palmer, there's a shout. A laborer strides towards him, yelling, reprimanding Palmer for shooting a bird in the middle of the street, and another man's bird at that. Palmer is incensed at the man's impudence. His face grows even redder. He shouts back that if the man would stay while he reloads his weapon, he'll shoot him too. The laborer backs away, leaving Palmer furiously reloading his pistol, alone in the middle of the road. By the time he's primed the gun and pulled back the hammer, the road is empty. Palmer grunts and shoves the pistol back into his pocket. He adjusts his wig and strides towards the inn, yanking open the door. Little does Palmer know that as he stamps upstairs to his room, the farmer and laborer are on their way to fetch the constable. It's not long before they're back, and they're not alone. Three justices of the peace have come to take statements on the incident. They arrest Palmer and make plans to bind him over to keep the peace. But Palmer refuses to pay the fee. With his guns confiscated, he is transported 20 miles or so to the nearby market town of Beverly. There, he is committed to the House of Correction with other petty offenders until the justices have concluded their investigation. Little do they know, the man they have in custody is no petty offender. The gentleman in the cells they know as John Palmer, the Lincolnshire man, is in fact Dick Turpin, notorious highwayman. History is full of men and women who live outside the law. Some are heroes, others are villains. Many are both. Each week, we'll take you on a journey into the life and times of notorious outlaws, from Billy the Kid and Ned Kelly to Anne Bonny and Al Capone. We'll delve deep into their stories to find out how legends were born and continue to grow, often long after they're gone. I'm Nathan Wiley, and this is Real Outlaws. Following the breakup of the infamous Essex gang that kick-started his life of crime, Dick Turpin takes to robbing travelers on the dark, lonely highways north of London. But when he shoots and kills his partner in crime, and then murders a warden of the forest in his bid to escape, he is forced to flee further afield, some 200 miles north. Winding up in Yorkshire, he's been hiding out as a gentleman, hoping he can escape the past. But has he really put his criminal life behind him? And if so, how did his legend come to be resurrected and appropriated, turning the bloodthirsty killer into a folk hero? It's ironic that after such a prolific crime spree, it's a temper tantrum with a cockerel that finally lands Dick Turpin in a prison cell. One can easily imagine the feeling of disbelief and regret Turpin now feels, sitting on his jail bed, contemplating his future. Yet, for now, the authorities still don't know him by his real name, and therefore are unaware of the importance of their prisoner. The anti-hero of legend has always seemed to be one step ahead of the law, allegedly riding from London to York in a single night to make his daring escape, ready to go out in a blaze of glory as all good heroes do. So this cruel act and its ignominious conclusion doesn't fit with the image of the dashing, dandy highwayman that we know and love. Our skewed ideas about the highwayman Dick Turpin owe much to a Manchester man named William Ainsworth. As a child in the early 1800s, nearly 70 years after Turpin's days, young Ainsworth sits on his father's knee, listening to the stories of the daring knights of the road, the highwaymen of times gone by. He grows up surrounded by local legends, the great Catholic families of Lancashire and Yorkshire and their bloody histories, Jacobite uprisings, rebels, outlaws, and bandits. As an adult, Ainsworth takes to writing without much success, until he blends all these themes together in his gothic novel, Rookwood. Published in 1834, almost a century after Turpin's death, Rookwood is an instant bestseller, a tragic romance revolving around the troubles of a once great noble family. But it is a second character that really grabs the public's imagination, a dashing highwayman named Dick Turpin, who rides a jet black mare named Black Bess. Turpin's epic ride north to York turns out to be the highlight of the novel. James Sharp is a professor emeritus at the University of York and author of Dick Turpin, The Myth of the English Highwayman.
If you look, there are all sorts of compendia of highwayman stories coming out in the 18th century. Turpin doesn't figure very much. He's not one of the people who is much remembered. over the period. So you have the problem, yeah, why does he suddenly crop up in Rookwood in 1834? There was a reissue of Richard Bayes's, the landlord who was involved in the shooting of Matthew King. He wrote a biography of Turpin in 1739. There was a reprinting of that about 1800, in which the ride to York, interestingly, was appended as something which Turpin had done. So that's about 1800. That's the earliest example I know of that. So that story is circulating.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
I'm historian Ruth Goodman, host of Noise's newest podcast, The Curious History of Your Home. I spent my life investigating the hidden history of everyday objects. The vacuum cleaner in your cupboard, sleek and compact today. But when it was invented, it was literally powered by horses and took 4 to 6 people to operate. The minty fresh toothpaste by your sink. Well, if you lived in ancient Greece, you'd be washing your teeth with ground up bones and oyster shells. Double glazed windows? We owe those to a French king's odd fascination with oranges. The Curious History of Your Home explores the extraordinary in the ordinary. Listen to The Curious History of Your Home each Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts. From award-winning podcasters Noiser, The Curious History of Your Home.
While numerous poems, novels, songs, and reference books are written on highwaymen, it is largely William Harrison Ainsworth we have to thank for pulling Dick Turpin out of obscurity and breathing life back into him. Ainsworth stitches the real exploits of other highwaymen together with dubious legends about Turpin. The enhanced version of Dick Turpin in 1834's Rookwood, sitting astride his faithful mare, Black Bess, inadvertently becomes the most famous highwayman of them all.
And there was also, which may have been feeding in somewhere, country dance called Black Bess, which, as far as I know, is totally unrelated to Turpin, but which I think was current in the 18th and early 19th centuries. There was a book, again demonstrating how Turpin is beginning to be remembered again, published, I think, in 1825, which does mention Turpin riding on his black mare, Bess. I think Ainsworth in Rookwood had this very felicitous alliteration, calling her Black Bess. Once this idea of a black mare Bess comes up, you can maybe see how Black Bess comes into it. And the connection with the ride to York, I think, was beginning to develop in this period as well.
The myth is cemented 6 years after Rookwood, when Henry Miles publishes his novel, Dick Turpin, putting the dashing hero front and center. He includes Black Bess and recycles the epic ride to York. Miles's novel sets the tone for the mythical figure who has come to represent all highwaymen today.
You've got the beginning of modern compendia of highwaymen stories being produced from the mid-19th century onwards. So the highwayman, as we know him today, does seem to be established very quickly in the aftermath of Rookwood and has got almost everything to do with Dick Turpin, the creation of the Turpin legend in the 19th century.
The reality of Turpin's ride north is somewhat different to the legend. Following the apparently accidental killing of his partner in crime, Matthew King, the heat gets too much for Dick Turpin, and he flees to his hideout in Epping Forest. When he's traced there by a lone and unwise keeper of the forest, Turpin kills him as well. It's easy to imagine our hero slinking quietly up the Great North Road to Lincolnshire to lie low before crossing into Yorkshire. He arrives in Brough, 26 miles outside York. Once there, he establishes a new identity, passing himself off as a gentleman named John Palmer. Quietly maintaining criminal activities by night to fund his new lifestyle, by day, he hobnobs with the local gentry. To all appearances, he's got off scot-free. But apparently, the bad-tempered Turpin can't keep a lid on his surly disposition for long. After stupidly killing a cockerel in the road, he threatens a local man with a pistol. Unfortunately for Turpin, the man will not be bullied.
He goes to local justices of the peace and says, "This man, John Palmer, has been threatening me with a pistol. I want him bound over to keep the peace," which is, you know, similar processes these days. And what this means is that the person being bound over has to provide what are called sureties. And the normal thing would be for, you know, the person being bound over to, say, provide a surety of £10 and to find two other people, each of whom would provide £5. And these sureties would be forfeit if the person bound over committed a breach of the peace in the interim. They're normally bound over for a year. So the idea is to defuse the situation. And this is a remarkably common device. It's something which is very widely used. Now, I think the problem is that Turpin, being a relative stranger in the area, doesn't have people who will put up the surety for him. So he can't be bound over to keep the peace, which would have been fairly sort of non-onerous routine sort of thing to do. It's not pleasant, but it doesn't provide you with massive problems. And what the justices then do, which is one of the very few things they can do, is put Turpin in the House of Correction at Beverley.
While the man they know as Palmer languishes in a Beverley jail, a particularly tenacious justice of the peace decides to dig a little deeper. He investigates Palmer's finances, but can establish no income. The landlord of the Ferry Inn, where the stranger has been lodging, tells the magistrate that Palmer would often make trips over the border into Lincolnshire, returning with horses to sell in Yorkshire. No one seems to know how Palmer makes his money, despite living like a gentleman.
We've got the evidence of the people accusing him in the East Riding Record Office in Beverley. I mean, these documents exist. Certain suspicions begin to fly around. I mean, the people giving evidence actually say that he's held to be a gentleman, but nobody knows much about him. Nobody knows exactly how he earns his living. And I think the justices would be pushing this a bit further. And then reports come through that John Palmer is a horse dealer. He's fetching horses from Lincolnshire across the Humber into the East Riding and selling them off on further up in Yorkshire.
Turpin, still purporting to be John Palmer, spins a sorry story of a life dealing sheep in Long Sutton, Lincolnshire, which was cut short by disease, after which he moves to Yorkshire. He even tells them the name of his hometown and further personal details to ease their minds. But if Turpin thinks the magistrates will leave it there, he's very much mistaken.
The justices are obviously regarding him as a slightly suspicious character. And in fact, they write to this JP in Long Sutton saying, "We've got this guy in custody who claims to have lived in Long Sutton and who claims that his father lives there. Can you tell us anything about him?" Now, Justice of the Peace is a sort of local law enforcement officer who lives in Long Sutton, who writes back saying, "Yeah, we know John Palmer," as his name is then. "But we know John Palmer, he's wanted for sheep theft."
Meanwhile, another blow arrives from Lincolnshire. A farmer who has recently had horses stolen has had a stroke of luck. It's another nail in Turpin's coffin. He hears tales of a man named Palmer suspected of horse theft. The farmer travels to Yorkshire and manages to track his own stolen horses down. Each buyer gives exactly the same story. They bought the horse from John Palmer at Brough. Evidence against John Palmer is mounting and the authorities' interest increases. Coupled with accusations of horse theft, it appears their prisoner is a bigger fish than they thought. Turpin is transferred to a high-security jail.
Horse theft is a serious crime, so you wouldn't hold somebody in a house of correction on suspicion of horse theft. So Turpin is sent over, under escort, of course, to the county jail at York.
While most convicted of horse theft would be punished by long prison sentences, backbreaking labor, or transportation to the colonies, many others are executed. Turpin, alias Palmer, is now facing potential execution. Ironically, the same punishment he'd face if he were tried as a highwayman. The usual method of execution for any criminal in Georgian Britain is hanging.
Broadly, you can be executed for a very wide range of offences. Murder, obviously. Grand larceny, which was defined as theft of more than a shilling, which is a paltry amount by the early 18th century. Horse theft, which is a separate offence. Burglary, housebreaking. Rape, arson, bigamy, even.
In London, Turpin's deceased pals from the Essex gang are still rotting in irons after being hanged at the famous Tyburn. To take a ride to Tyburn has long been a euphemism for capital punishment, as is to dance the Tyburn jig. If found guilty, Turpin can expect to end up at York Tyburn, the northern city's place of execution, which takes its name from its relative in London. The gallows stands on the Knavesmire, a patch of open ground on the main road into the city, so visitors can look up at the grim structure. Perhaps they'll even see a few bodies swinging as they pass, a grisly reminder of the consequences of breaking the law in Yorkshire. Just like the Tyburn in London, York's gallows is also triangular in shape and is nicknamed the Three-Legged Mare. Public executions attract huge crowds, with stands erected for spectators with deep pockets. The method used is known as the short drop, a lingering, painful death writhing at the end of the rope. As a noose is placed about their neck, the condemned criminal is expected to act bravely and say a few words, to put on a bit of a show for those who've turned out, and as Georgians put it, to die game. While swinging at the end of a rope is a potential outcome of a horse theft trial, Turpin is confident that as a first offense in his guise of John Palmer, he can escape a date with the hangman.
The way a trial would work is that the accused would attempt to sway the court by getting, you know, as it were, previous employers or clergymen who knew them, or, you know, people of local standing where they had, you know, allegedly committed offence. They would get them to come and swear to their good character. So the argument would be, I mean, okay, this man has committed horse theft, but he's had a blameless life up to now. We would recommend him for mercy. Or the standard thing by 1739 was to send people to the American colonies, to Maryland or Virginia, to work as indentured servants rather than execute them.
For this reason, he writes to his brother-in-law in Essex in early 1739. He asks for witnesses to travel north to York to speak to his good character, or rather, that of John Palmer's.
What Turpin is doing is writing to his brother-in-law, saying, I'm in York under an assumed name of John Palmer. Can you find people who will come up to York and swear that John Palmer is a good bloke? And, you know, if he is convicted of this horse theft, it's the first time he's done it. It's out of character. He ought to get a secondary punishment rather than be executed.
The letter is dispatched south. Now all Turpin can do is wait for a reply. His fate, quite literally, hangs in the balance. But the postal system of Georgian England operates very differently from the Royal Mail of today. Conveyed by rider or coach, it's not a speedy process. And, on arrival, post is delivered to a local shop or an inn and the recipient is informed. They come, pay a fee, and collect the letter. That's how it's supposed to work, anyway.
Turpin's brother-in-law goes to examine this letter and he says, I've no correspondent in York. So we don't know if he simply didn't want to pay because he didn't want to pay, or if he recognized Turpin's handwriting and thought, I don't want anything to do with this because it's going to cause trouble.
Either way, it's yet another stroke of bad luck for Turpin. But a far worse one is about to walk through the door. In an incredible turn of events, another Essex man is picking up his post when he sees the letter from York.
If you were writing an historical novel, this would be straining credibility, because one of the people who does see the letter is a man called James Smith, who, as a monitor in school, had actually taught Turpin to write, and he recognises the handwriting.
The address on the envelope is damning. Smith would know Turpin's hand anywhere. When inquiries prove it was sent for the attention of Turpin's brother-in-law and returned unopened, Smith leads the charge. Whether out of moral fortitude, a sense of public duty, or with the £200 reward in mind, Smith helps to identify the notorious outlaw. He informs the local magistrate, who at once pays the postage fee and opens the letter.
Presumably, he says the brother-in-law doesn't want it, but I think it's written by Richard Turpin, and the local JPs go in, open it, and discover it's from somebody called John Palmer in York, who's being held for horse theft. And at that stage, Turpin is in real trouble.
After reading the contents, the magistrate asks James Smith to travel to York to visit this John Palmer in the cells there and identify him as Dick Turpin.
Suddenly he's identified as Richard Turpin, the highway robber and murderer who's wanted for a slew of offences in Essex and the London area. So, yeah, at this stage, Turpin's alias is blown.
Turpin's letter to Essex for a character witness has been answered, but in the worst way possible. Horse theft is the least of his worries now. The Secretary of State, the Duke of Newcastle, is immediately notified that Turpin is in custody. He arranges for the outlaw to be transported 200 miles south to London to stand trial for highway robbery and murder. But he is thwarted. By chance, the magistrate who first arrested Turpin for shooting the cockerel is a member of Parliament and a big supporter of the Prime Minister.
One of the East Riding justices who is originally, JP's originally involved in Turpin's arrest, is very anxious to keep the offence in York. One suspects that it's because his brother is a lawyer and would have been one of the lawyers for the prosecution if it had stayed in York. It's after all in York, Yorkshire, that Turpin has been apprehended for horse theft, so it's felt to be right and proper by the local authorities in York.
It's a grim irony that Turpin's success as a villain and his celebrity as an outlaw results in a tug of war over who should have the honor of hanging him. On March 22nd, 1739, the notorious murderer and highwayman stands trial for common horse theft. James Smith from Essex is back to publicly testify before the court that John Palmer, horse thief, is in fact also gentleman of the road, Dick Turpin. The secret is well and truly out. Although the fact that he's a renowned robber is irrelevant as far as the horse theft charges go, the revelation likely goes a long way to convincing the jury of Turpin's guilt in the matter at hand. Also, the chance of receiving a lenient sentence seems unlikely. In the end, the guilty verdicts are delivered without the jury even leaving the room. When the judge asks Turpin if there is any reason the death sentence should not be pronounced, he begs more time to prepare a defense.
And at the end of the trial, Turpin objects and says, look, I haven't had time to prepare my defense properly. I've no time to get, friends. They use the term friends, which is a much broader term in this period. I haven't been able to get in touch with them to come up. And the judge says, sorry, you've known the date of the trial for a long time. That's not going to wash. So that is the last possible way out taken away from him.
Dick Turpin is taken to the condemned cell in York Castle Prison to await his fate. In the following fortnight, with his real identity confirmed, people flock to speak with him. His guard makes 100 pounds, selling wine and spirits to visitors. Turpin enjoys the notoriety and plays on his fame. But fame is fleeting, and his time in this world is coming to an end. He is not just the most famous highwayman, but also one of the last. Dick Turpin and highway robbery in general is about to be consigned to history. The downfall of highwaymen is thought to be due to a combination of factors. The Enclosure Act of 1773 introduces more barriers in the countryside, enclosing common land and walling in roads, which makes it far more difficult to pounce on an unsuspecting victim. From the mid-1700s, there's also a huge rise in broad, well-constructed turnpike roads, with frequent toll gates and fees. These toll booths are designed to be difficult to avoid or dodge, which means highwaymen are at a greater risk of being seen or cornered. From this period, banknotes grow in prominence over coins. They are much easier to trace, and since a banknote's value is in its face, it cannot be melted down or repurposed like gold and silver coins and jewelry. As the highwaymen themselves die out on the roads, they are reborn in literature. The earliest blood-curdling pamphlets spread stories ranging from dashing heroism to cutthroat villainy. Highwaymen, along with their nautical cousins, the pirates, are a surefire bestseller.
There is a tremendous vogue from the mid-19th century onwards for highwaymen stories. And these are especially coming through, for example, in penny dreadfuls. Yeah, these cheap publications for adolescents and young men of the lower classes. And these are produced in prodigious numbers and are very, very widely read.
In 1846, Dick Turpin is immortalized at Madame Tussaud's House of Wax. Victorian novels aimed at young boys regularly feature dashing and courageous highwaymen, and Turpin is a favorite. Over the centuries, the myth continues to grow through countless retellings on page, stage, and screen. The character of Dick Turpin has followed a common tradition of romanticizing British criminals, morphing into a courageous and audacious social bandit in the Robin Hood tradition. That myth is now a well-established part of pop culture.
Why is it that people like me, who are very law-abiding, not very worried about crime, but as worried about crime as most people, watch TV crime series? I think it's taking us out of ourselves. Outlaws, you know, like Ned Kelly, for example, can be romanticised. You know, and then Ned Kelly is perhaps a more appealing figure, obviously, a large element in the Australian psyche. I just think that there's something in all of us, which most of us most of the time keep suppressed, that would like to be an outlaw, so long as we don't get executed.
10 a.m. on the 7th of April, 1739. It's an unseasonably cold morning as a cart rumbles across the cobbles in front of York Jail. In the back sits a 33-year-old Dick Turpin, calm, quiet, and alert. As the cart passes into the shadow of the old castle, it is joined by five men who follow solemnly. They are paid mourners, with £3.10 of Turpin's money to be shared between them. He splashed the last of his cash elsewhere, too. He distributed hat bands and gloves to spectators and is wearing a smart new frock coat and pumps. The mourners in fancy clothes are all part of the spectacle of a good Georgian public execution. A villain is expected to put on a good show. They're expected to die game. And like many of the most famous outlaws, Turpin knows how to play to a crowd. To one side of Turpin sits a less well-dressed man, another convicted horse thief sentenced to hang alongside him. But as the cart rattles up the steep cobbled hill of Micklegate, all eyes are on Turpin. On the other side of him in the cart lies his coffin. His corpse will make the journey back into the city on the same cart. Turpin bows his head soberly at the crowds lining the street as the cart passes through Micklegate Bar, the medieval gateway in the city walls, where traditionally the heads of rebels would be stuck on spikes. Out onto the Tadcaster Road, the crowds are thicker, jostling into their path and having to be pushed back by guards walking ahead of the cart. The armed guards at either side of the cart straighten a little in their saddles. They're worried Turpin will try to escape, or that he has supporters in the crowd to spirit him away. They needn't worry. It seems Turpin's legend has already overtaken the man. The real Turpin has no friends, nor any fantastic escape plan. Turpin simply sits, bouncing in the back of the cart, contemplating his final moments. In the fields in the distance, he can see the three-legged mare. He shudders. As they draw closer, he can make out the ladder propped against one side. It takes nearly an hour to get from the prison to the Tyburn, only a mile outside the city walls. It should have taken less than half that, but the crowds are swelling by the minute. Cheering, jeering, shouting and swearing, loud prayers and even louder denunciations. People in the crowd have differing views on the outlaw, but all are expectant of a spectacle. Finally, just before 11 a.m., the cart draws up alongside the scaffold. More guards hold back the crowds as Dick Turpin climbs down. He looks about, as if drawing out his final moments, but is ushered towards the ladder. He climbs two steps. His left leg trembles. He stamps it down defiantly. To gasps from the crowds, Turpin looks around at the throng gathered to watch his final moments. Silence descends as he climbs the remaining steps. He pauses and turns to speak a few quiet words with the executioner. Ironically, a convicted highwayman himself, pardoned for carrying out today's grim duty, as is a custom at York. No sooner is the noose placed around Turpin's neck than the highwayman boldly leaps from the scaffold. It's a fearless, final act of defiance. His neck does not break immediately, and Turpin hangs twitching for long minutes. Then, his body is still. It is left swinging in the cold wind until long after the crowds have dispersed. Finally, at 3 p.m., when there can be no question of his death, he is cut down and laid in the coffin, to be taken on the same journey back into the city.
I think, like most highwaymen, he appears to be picking relatively easy targets. Yeah, it makes sense. He's very rarely robbing stagecoaches. You know, you've got this image of the highwayman robbing stagecoaches. That's pretty dangerous. And of course, with the Matthew King shooting, for example, Turpin disappears immediately. So I don't think he's an amazingly courageous criminal. What we do know is that at his execution, he did die bravely. You know, people expected, especially criminals like highwaymen, to die bravely when they were executed. Turpin shows a bit of nervousness on the gallows, but he suppresses it, and he dies bravely. So at the end, he makes a good end.
Following Dick Turpin's execution, his body is laid out for curious onlookers at the Blue Boar Tavern, close to the prison. The next morning, it is taken to St. George's Church, behind York Castle, and buried in an unremarkable plot in an otherwise unremarkable graveyard, with no grand ceremony and no great epitaph. The following Tuesday, the body is dug up by body snatchers to sell for medical research. It is a common occurrence, discreetly tolerated by authorities, but it is not tolerated by the God-fearing public. The body snatchers are soon apprehended by a mob, and Dick Turpin is reburied. This time, quicklime is added to speed up the corpse's breakdown. He was a notorious criminal, and his execution is big news. But this lawless era produces several notorious villains a year. Dick Turpin is soon superseded by the next colorful character, with the effect that after several years, very few people remember him at all. Soon, he is forgotten, ready to rise phoenix-like in fictionalized form a century later. Today, on a quiet lane in York, visitors still flock to Turpin's grave, notable for being inscribed with two names. John Palmer, otherwise Richard Turpin, the notorious highwayman and horse stealer executed at Tyburn, April 7th, 1739, and buried in St. George's Churchyard. Yorkshire, and York in particular, has adopted the highwayman. Various places in Yorkshire boast a Dick Turpin connection, so great is his mythical pull, and if all the commemorative plaques on inns along the Great North Road are to be believed, it's a wonder he managed to stay in his saddle.
I'm not going to go to every pub up the North Road and say this is wrong. I mean, the reception would be frosty, I think. And I just think people like these legends. You know, Dick Turpin is a figure which wrongly is regarded with considerable sympathy, and it adds a bit of romance.
Nobody at his execution in 1739, including Turpin himself, would guess that his image would symbolize an entire bygone form of criminality, or represent a rose-tinted view of Georgian romantic adventure.
The strongest example I can bring to mind is how legend overtakes history. And I think one of the most interesting things about Turpin is that, yeah, unlike, for example, Robin Hood, about whom I think we know absolutely nothing as a real historical figure, with Turpin you can reconstruct something of the historical reality and also absolutely pin down where the legend comes from and how it develops. But I think, yeah, understanding why that legend took off is really very, very difficult. Turpin somehow does seem to have struck a very responsive chord with the reading, film-going, theatre-going, TV-watching, your public. And this is often one of the most fascinating aspects, that you've got this not awfully distinguished, not awfully famous 18th century highwayman who, you know, suddenly becomes the key figure in our conception of what highwaymen are like and turns up in all sorts of different places. So, you know, there are even people in the early 20th century who claim to have met him. Yes, it's just crazy, you know. I think the legend and the man are really very, very distant.
Our Dick Turpin is mainly mythical, invented in literature and embellished over time with the exploits of other, perhaps more worthy, historical figures. Fantasy is now taken as fact and represented on plaques on the walls of old coaching inns the length of the country. But neither the historical nor mythical version of Dick Turpin is necessarily wrong. The real question is, does Dick Turpin, the appalling, sadistic villain that he was, deserve such a legacy? Next time on Real Outlaws, it's the 1930s and the American heartland is in the grip of a crime wave. Devastated by the Great Depression, banks have gone bust, taking people's life savings with them. In this cruel period of American history, an unlikely hero will emerge. Well, a hero to some, anyway. To the authorities, he's public enemy number one. An average guy from rural Indiana is about to burst onto the national stage. We discover how a young boy became the man of legend, serial bank robber John Dillinger. That is next time on Real Outlaws. If you're enjoying Noiser podcasts and would like to hear them without adverts, join Noiser Plus today. As well as ad-free listening to Noiser originals, including Real Outlaws, Real Dictators, Short History Of, and History Daily, you'll get bonus content and early access to new episodes. Start your free trial today with Noiser Plus.